You're listening to a Hebrew in Israel podcast with Yoel Halevi, exploring the language, culture, and history of the Bible. For more information, visit us at HebrewInIsrael.net.
Shalom everyone, welcome again to another episode of Tzohar LaMikra. I truly hope that you've enjoyed all the recordings up to now. And I have a few other recordings in the makings. I've done actually a recording about the whole subject of Malkit Tzedek, a few insights, new things that have come to light with my studies. And this week, another portion, another Torah portion. And we are in Parashat Va'era. The word Va'era actually means to appear. Interesting enough, it's actually the second verse in this parasha. And first of all, I want to point out something that a lot of people are probably aware of, but don't really discuss these things too much, are the elements of how the chapters are divided, how the book are divided, the books are divided to chapters. And those of you who actually have a Hebrew Bible in front of you will see that Vayera actually is the beginning of a new section, a new parashia, because the Torah is divided up into parashot, they're divided up into books, sfarim. Then you have, in the sfarim themselves, in the books, they have the parashot, which are the portions we read today based on the Babylonian cycle, which finishes everything once a year. For those who don't know, there were two cycles that existed. One which was once a year, where you have to sometimes read more than one parasha to complete the cycle and have it end around Sukkot. And another one which was the one done in Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel, for a very, very long time, and also partially in Egypt, because there was a strong connection between the Jews living in the land of Israel and the Jews living in Egypt, and a lot of traditions about the practices in the land of Israel we actually know from the Cairo Nizah and other sources as well. And they used to read the Torah every 3 years, 3 to 3.5 years. And what's interesting is also how much they actually read, because what it meant was that if you do every three to three and a half years, you actually had to read just a few verses. And that's actually what we find in the Mishnah. The Mishnah describes to us a reality where people would read something like 20-something verses, 21 verses, which when each person that got up to read from the Torah had to read about 3 verses. Because what they really had was he had 7 people who were readers, excuse me, and then a last person who would read a few verses, 3 verses again from the Torah, and then they would read from the prophets. And actually, the prophets have come up lately with a few discussions that I've had regarding what is the purpose. I've actually written about it, but I'll talk about it again here just for a moment. The history is a little vague sometimes, but it seems to be that the practice of reading the Haftarot came to be when the Romans forbid Jews from reading from the Torah in public. And what they would do is they would read from the prophets, because they would say, look, this is not the Torah, this is a different, completely different book, you can compare it, you can say it's not the same. And the Romans actually had this vicious behavior towards Jewish books at one point, because the Romans, very much like the Seleucids, especially Antioch IV, recognized the religion as the element that kind of changed the way Jews were in comparison to other nations around them. This is the reason why the Romans had great difficulty controlling Judea. And so they actually went against the religion. The Romans also developed at this time a great hatred towards Jews. It's a paradox that they had, because on one hand they respected Jews because Judaism was actually a very old religion, a religion that they knew was very, very old. But on the other hand, they saw Judea and Jews as barbarians, like they saw many other people around them. And the Romans had an interior conflict, very much like some people in the Western world, that they see themselves as the elite, but they also have a lot of respect towards old cultures. But then on the other hand, they have hatred towards different people because they don't want to follow what they believe in. And this paradox continues. Anti-Semitism is mostly based on what happened with the Romans, because other nations, it was usually just a struggle between ethnic groups. It wasn't really hatred on that level, and anti-Semitism really started with Rome, was propagated by the by the Catholic Church, and actually the other churches as well. It's not just the Catholic Church, it was the other churches that existed as well. And there was also, for example, around the 8th and 9th centuries, there was a lot of fear that Jews would influence Christians. So there was even more. There were Christians who started keeping Sabbath, some groups that kept Sabbath, and we hear about Christian monks who fought against this, especially in the Carolingian kingdom. And not in the Merovingians that much, but amongst the Carolingians, there was more of a leniency towards knowledge. They wanted people to know. They actually developed libraries and what some people presume is public education. So a lot of people were slightly more educated, so they were leaning more towards Jews. And there were groups of people that realized that the church is not really telling us what the Bible says, and they started keeping Torah to some degree, and there was a struggle with it. But in any case, we're kind of straying away from the main subject here. And actually, there were several subjects here that we're talking about, but the element here is that there was a persecution of Jewish inscriptions, and therefore Jewish scriptures, and therefore they were tearing up books. One of the interesting things that you find, interesting and yet sad, is that the Romans used to rip up books. A lot of books were found torn, for example, in Masada. So they would read actually from the prophets something which will parallel the parallel what's written in the Torah or the period of the time. For example, when I have my bar mitzvah, when I have my reading, which is Nitzavim, the reading is more about Sheva de Nehemta, the seven prophecies of comfort. And before that, the Sheva de Pur Anuta, the seven prophecies of destruction. So there's a connection here to the periods, and there's also a connection here to the parasha itself. So they're basically paralleling it. And the thing is that in Judaism, very commonly, those who are following the program, they're also doing about oral Torah. The moment something turns into a custom and it's there from 2, 3, 4 generations, it becomes law, and that creates a lot of confusing elements inside Judaism that a lot of people try to understand but don't really understand how the Jewish mind perceives customs, because the Judaism, and even before the creation of what we know today as Judaism, the law of Israel in general was mostly oral. For more details, you need to listen to the we're now in almost part 14 of this series. You really need to listen from the beginning to really understand the complexities of understanding law, custom, and beliefs in the ancient world. It's all based on academic research. It's not stuff that I pulled out of the air. There's a few researchers I've been using to develop this information. But in any case, so instead of canceling the reading of the Haftarah, they started practicing reading this side by side. So it's something that's really the origins of it, for those who wonder. And for those who keep on hearing this excuse about Isaiah 53, it wasn't hidden or anything. There was never a cycle of reading from the prophets. There are some people who try to claim this based on something that's mentioned in the Jerusalem Talmud, but it's extremely vague. It's so vague that it's very difficult to even really come to any clear conclusion. But in any case, nothing was hidden. It was just, it didn't fit any other discussions that appear in the Torah, and therefore was never put into the cycle. It's a very false argument. But in any case, for those who might be hearing about this thing, it's just something that came up, and several people have asked me about it, and I just thought I'll say something in a recording about it. In any case, so also the division of the books, if you look at it, the beginning of chapter 6 is really at the end of an entire section. This is one of the great criticisms regarding the Christian division of the Bible and how it was actually done to manipulate certain interpretations to bring people to certain conclusions. So it's very important to pay attention to where things stop, and you can actually see these stops as well, especially in the Torah, also in other versions of the Torah, especially the Samaritans. They also break it down to different sections. So it's very important to understand the differences between the Christian Bible, the Christian, not canon, but the Bible itself, the way the chapters are divided, versus how the Jewish Bible really shows up and the logical division of sections. In any case, the verse 3 actually says, Va'era el Avraham el Yitzhak vel Yaakov be'el Shaddai. Ushmi Yud Hei Vav Hei Lo Nodati Lahem. For those, again, who wonder why I'm willing to say Yud Hei Vav Hei, is because the prohibition is not to actually say the letters. The prohibition is to say the letters with the vowel points. When it says afa, when Rabbi Akiva says afa ogeta shem beotiyotav, he's not referring to a prohibition of saying the letters. He's referring to a prohibition to actually pronounce the name with its vowel points. A lot of Jewish manuscripts up to about 400 years ago would write yud he and vav he and yud vav and so on, and this idea of replacing combinations that might indicate a name of God or avoiding saying the letters of the name itself. It's something, I wouldn't say new, but it's just a development that came on more and more and more until today. We hear people refusing to say the word Elohim and the name Adonai, which are considered to be kinuyim. These are more titles and less the actual name, and the prohibition was never about it. We actually find the word Elohim show up over and over again in a lot of sources where people would say the word Elohim as a form of oath. And really the idea was that you always take an oath in the name of your God. So there's never actually a halachic prohibition. The prohibition is something new that's really more out of a custom of people who revere the name of God so much that they're even avoiding writing even the word God with an O. They will write G-D, which is something I'm very, very against. And people who write it, I understand they're trying to respect others, but at the end of the day, it's nonsense. I mean, the prohibition to write certain words in places where you can't erase them, so even to write them on the internet is ridiculous. There was even a decree from the Badatz of the Adah Haredi, which is one of the big halachic bodies, forums in the Jewish world, one of the more important ones, and it said that typing on a computer is not considered to be writing. So there's really, you can even write the name of God with vowel points on a screen and really erase it, and it really has no meaning, because writing is the act of actually putting ink onto paper or some kind of source and write it. And this is another thing that I point out a lot in the recordings about the oral Torah and the changes, the differences between different periods and understanding the developments that happened and realizing that what a lot of people hear today about Judaism is not necessarily the Judaism of everyone or the Judaism of the sages. And though a lot of people try to say, oh, we trust the sages, but then they do something completely different. And it's something needs to be deeply understood. So again, I recommend listening to all the recordings. But in any case, he says here that he appeared, he revealed himself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob by the name El Shaddai. But the name Yud Hey Vav Hey was not known to them. This is obviously not necessarily an idea of them not knowing the actual name itself, though usually using a specific name is also revealing that name. But I think one of the best explanations to what this actually means is that the governing under the name Yud Hey Vav Hey was not there. That the name itself represents a different type of covenant, a different type of structure of rulership. And by naming something in the ancient world, and I've pointed this out in the last recording, you actually define things. You know, Adam is bought animals to give them names, and the names were defined based on the reality of the animal. So very similar to this, in the ancient world, they would understand that a name has a very strong effect on the presence of someone or something, and therefore by using the actual tetragrammaton, God is governing or reveals himself in a slightly different way of control and kingship, rather than, for example, a name like El Shaddai, which actually has also somewhat of a generic meaning. El Shaddai, again, the discussion of why the name El, isn't that a Phoenician god, and Shaddai, what does that mean? There's a lot of interesting discussions about this, which is not the place for this, because it's an entire subject by itself that I've been studying for quite a while and still don't have a full answer of exactly explaining everything. But you have to understand that the name El and Shaddai are very generic. They represent an aspect of God. They don't represent his actual being or presence, which the tetragrammaton actually does represent. So the explanation, this is usually the explanation in Judaism in general, in the rabbinic sources, that the governing concept of the tetragrammaton was not in effect, and therefore the patriarchs didn't necessarily use that name, because that wasn't the element God was governing them by. And the fact that the tetragrammaton appears in the book of Genesis doesn't contradict this, because you have to remember the writing of the book of Genesis was after the fact. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they actually knew the name of God. And this also goes into the whole discussion, did they know Torah and so on? And there's a lot of speculation here. And a lot of this speculation, by the way, goes back into the Second Temple and the different groups that existed back then, which is going to be a feature in this recording as well. Now, One of the things that's very interesting, a lot of people discuss here, and probably one of the more interesting features I had to study, for example, in high school in Jewish philosophy, which by itself is an oxymoron, because Jews were trying to prove that philosophy, especially during the second and first centuries, or third and second centuries BC, they were trying to show that philosophy is an integral part of Judaism, and that philosophy came from Judaism. A lot of these interesting ideas, which obviously historically are inaccurate, and they had to do with trying to glorify oneself in the eyes of a lot of nations and a lot of the philosophers of the time and people who were easily convinced of certain ideas. And this is, again, another feature that's very common in people who belong to the old world, where you say something and it's relatively convincing, unlike the way we do things today, especially in the research world, where you need to actually have evidence and prove things. People are very impressionable, especially in religious circles that haven't broken forth. And even people who are more of an academic type are still very impressionable. And it's very difficult to convince sometimes people of an idea, even if you present facts, because if a rabbi or a priest or an imam said something, that's it. That's the law and that's the reality, as if they have the ability to change reality by what they say. Which is very sad, by the way, extremely sad. But also we have to remember that if a scholar or researcher says something, you need to also take that with a grain of salt, unless they present ample evidence, which is something that I always encourage people. If you have evidence against what I say or anyone says, you have to bring it up. You know, even if they're offended, and it kind of unravels some of the work they've done. You know, if we're pursuing truth and not and the glory of God and not the glory of yourself, then you have to admit that you were wrong, which is very important. One of the interesting things that came up in some of the discussions that I had when I was in high school is the concept of free will. And there have been loads and loads of recordings about free will by different rabbis and scholars and teachers, which are all very, very interesting. And I think that this dilemma is something that bothers a lot of people, because I think this is a type of question that came into existence especially because of the Greeks. We need to understand the level of influence the Greeks had on the world in general and the discussions that they had with themselves. There's, I think, a massive difference between the way Jews or Israelites perceived the knowledge of God versus, I would say, the way the Greeks discussed the gods. You know, the thing is that regardless of the physical or human-like ideas that are sometimes equated to God in the Tanakh, we need to understand that the Israelites just probably used most of this as part of their world of metaphors and didn't really believe that God had a physical form, or even if they did believe that God had a physical form, like some scholars try to claim, like for example Ben Somer, who wrote a very interesting book about the subject called The Bodies of God, worth looking into, at least listen to the lectures or on iTunes. And even so, God is not represented as a human being. He's not represented with human flaws and things like that, though there are places where it seems to be, at least for the understanding of the reader, that God is presented with some level of humanity, just for us to kind of understand what was going on. But the Tanakh avoids going too deeply into the world of God's, you know, bursting into that sphere of the knowledge of God, the realm of God. And even in the cases where we have glimpses of the realm of God, you know, the prophets usually see it more like a spectator from the outside without really an inner understanding. They're not really bought too much into the inner sphere of God. They might be bought into the sod, into the counsel of God. By the way, the word sod changed throughout time and became the meaning of secret. But really, secrecy is part of the nature of a king's court, especially if it's a decision-making. And they don't really see the interior. They sometimes see some kind of representation of God in some kind of a physical understanding. But as we spoke about last time with the angel, the malach in the sneh, in the burning bush, it's a manifestation. It's not necessarily really God himself. God is usually presented in these very abstract ideas, things which are not that easy to fathom. And we don't really understand the nature of God as him himself. We only really have an understanding through the concepts of how he behaves with us. So one of the big problems that we have is that we usually perceive God as all-knowing and all-capable. And then on the other hand, we presumably have free will. We make a choice. We can decide what we do. And the question that's raised here, and it's a question that's raised in a lot of Jewish sources, like, for example, Sefer HaKuzari, a book that's written with the setting of the Khuzarians in the Black Steppes around the area of the Black Sea, that they presumably converted to Judaism. It's not really clear. Again, it's like the situation with the Edomites, that they really convert to Judaism. Was it something else? And there's a lot of details here that need to be discussed, which is really outside of the scope of the type of history I work with, so I can't really give pure answers here. But one thing I can say for sure is that the Khuzarians are not the origins of Jews. They were only the elite probably converted to Judaism, and even their version of Judaism wasn't exactly Judaism. And if anything, maybe several hundred people converted, and they assimilated at one point into the Jewish world. Like, you know, a lot of communities had converts, and there's always going to be converts in different places. It's like seeing a Caucasian who is a Muslim, though most people think Caucasians more as Christians and Arabs more as Mediterraneans, or Muslims more as Mediterraneans. But then you have people from Indonesia and so on. So it's when it comes to religions, it becomes a little different. It's no longer an ethnic matter. But one thing is, we know the history of Ashkenazi Jews, and it's a lot of the nonsense that comes out about this is just people's fantasies and hearsays, and it's really based on some silly Russian fantasy writer from back in the 1920s. But in any case, one of the problems that we have is, you know, Pharaoh on the one hand is a person and therefore should have free will, but on the other hand, God kind of limits him and says, oh, I will harden his heart. And, you know, if God knows everything and man has free will, how do these two things exist at the same time? So first of all, I have to really disappoint a lot of people by saying we actually don't know what it means that God knows. If he knows the future, what does it mean he knows the future? What is the concept of knowing? Is it the same as human beings knowing? How do you define the concept of knowing in the ancient world? What was the sensations people had when they knew? If they knew something, was it something that they understood only what's in front of them, but what's beyond them, they obviously understood that they can't know? Or does it mean that they were able to predict how people would behave based on the idea that people behave in certain patterns? A lot of these different concepts of what does it mean to know are interesting for philosophical things that people discuss in a lot of books, and I had to deal with some of this lately. But at the end of the day, we can only understand this in the sphere of man. We can't really understand this in the sphere of God, and therefore the discussion itself is futile. It is completely futile, because as God says to Job, when God appears in the storm at the end of the book of Job, he says, you know, you, Job, are unable to understand the movement of animals, the creation that surrounds you, things that you should be able to sense, to see with your own eyes. You can't comprehend the fullness of what they are. You don't have the ability to understand how I govern all of this. So many details, so many little things that exist in the universe, and big things that exist in the universe, and the creation. You as Job, and as a human being, basically, because the book of Job is a discussion about, I would say, the suffering of man, but really the relationship between God and man, and how God and man correspond with one another, and what does it mean that God intervenes in the world of man, and how does man have to relate to God? And God basically says to him, you will not have the comprehension of who I am, because you can barely understand the physical reality around you. Even today, with all the science that we have, we're still learning a lot of things. I, for example, just saw an article that four new elements have been added to the table. You know, things like that. So it's very questionable that we really understand everything. And this is the same thing. How can we discuss the nature of the Creator when we can barely understand the environment that's around us? I mean, so many of us can barely understand how our body functions. And this is our body. We're here inside this body. And we don't really comprehend everything about it. And each body is quite individual. And, you know, through, like, the subject of diets. So it's very, very difficult to even have a discussion about free will, because we don't really understand how God sees the universe. We don't have the ability to understand this. So what do we actually know about God? We know that he reacts to our behavior as a governor, as a king, that when we do things, he responds to it. But it doesn't tell us that he knows what we're going to decide. And there have been a lot of different discussions about this. So, for example, the Kuzari, specifically about this situation where Pharaoh the ability to decide is taken away from Pharaoh and his heart is hardened. There are a few opinions about this. For example, there's an opinion that says that his loss of free will is his punishment. That he actually has free will, and everyone has pure free will. And the punishment really comes of the fact that your free will is taken away from you, because Pharaoh decided to step beyond what he was allowed to do, and he started killing more and making them suffer more than what was actually planned. He was given a little bit, but he decided to step beyond that and step his bounds and really kind of go in a direction that was the reason that his free will was taken away from him. That's one opinion. Another opinion says that for the case of God trying to make a point in the world, free will was taken, and it was a choice made deliberately just for this case, and free will was not taken. It was just specifically for this case. Free will was taken, but specifically for this case, and people actually do have free will. But I need to step here into something a bit more historical. The discussion regarding free will, and if there actually is free will, was not something necessarily in the belief of Judaism from the get-go. During the Second Temple period, there were different groups, different sectarian groups, and they believed in different realities. On the two ends of the spectrum, we had the Sadducees that believe that you eat what you cook, and therefore, it's an expression, "tocharet deisa shebishalta," or something in that area. You basically receive what you do. So the Sadducees believe that here in this world, we need to do whatever we feel like, and we are responsible for our own decisions, and there's nothing governing us. God is there, but he doesn't intervene directly with our deeds, and therefore our free will is absolute, and we can do whatever we want, and our decision-makings are relative only to this existence, only to the world we live in, and it really doesn't affect anything else besides the world we live in, and they basically believe in absolute free will. On the other end of the spectrum were the, I don't know if to call them Essenes or some of the sectarian groups in the Second Temple period, because it's very dangerous to say Essenes, because we know there were probably more groups than just the Essenes. And there are even scholars try to claim the Essenes weren't real, that it was a general name for just a whole bunch of different groups. But Josephus tends to describe it as if there were three main sects at the time. And they believe that there is literally no free will whatsoever. They believed that you were either born of light or born of darkness. And they had this very dualistic idea of the universe that surrounded them, where you actually have physical characteristics that will put you in one of these groups. And these groups basically were characterized by hairs on your shoulders, hairs on your knuckles, a certain facial structure, body structure, and so on. That's how they would accept or deny people at the first stage if people wanted to join the Essene group, or Essene, or whatever sectarian group this was. So they didn't believe in free will at all. They believe that the universe is built in a structure that will eventually lead to a war between the sons of darkness, sons of light. And this also probably goes into this whole discussion about what exactly is a Jewish soul. A lot of people ask about this, and the people say, oh, there's a Jewish soul, and if you're not Jewish, you don't have this soul, and it's questionable if you have a soul. And it's kind of the nonsense that developed in that period. And the whole thing is very questionable in my eyes. But unfortunately, inside Judaism, you hear sparks of this. Because in the truth, the majority of the population wasn't in any one of these sects. The majority of the population just followed Torah, did what their ancestors did, and that was it. They weren't really part of this argument. But what's interesting are the Pharisees. The Pharisees took like a middle ground about this. The Pharisees believe that you have limited free choice, that you have the ability to choose certain actions, but eventually God does push you in certain directions. And the Pharisees were very middle ground, which probably also represented a lot of the opinions of the majority of people that said, listen, you know, on the one hand, we see that we can choose what we want to do, but on the other hand, we sometimes try to do something that doesn't work out for us. It was something more in testing the world. I think the Sadducees did the same thing. They, you know, like a lot of the Greeks, and the Greeks are very important here to our subject, but like a lot of the Greeks, they realize, oh, well, God doesn't strike me down when I do something. Therefore, maybe he doesn't really react to this. And this is where the Sadducees said, oh, you choose, but, you know, It's you can't you choose to do whatever you want to do, and your will is completely free. God doesn't force you. But the Pharisees tried to point out to realities, and you can sometimes see discussions like this somewhere in some place in the Talmud. And by the way, I apologize if you hear a child yelling in the background. It's my youngest. He's sick and he's at home, so you might hear children making noises sometimes. The reality of being a family man. But in any case, the thing that we have here is this reality of trying to understand the world around you. And what's very interesting is that when we look at the Greek world, not Greco-Roman, but the Greek world before the Romans, we find in the tragedies, especially the tragedies of Aeschylus, I'm sure how you pronounce it in English. In Greek, it's difficult to pronounce. In these tragedies, there are a lot of discussions about the fate of man. And the Greeks believed that your fate is controlled by the fates. And no matter what you do, the gods, even though they don't intervene that much, and there was actually at one point a break in the Greco-Roman or Greco world, even before the Romans became ruled the Greek world in the first century BC, a lot of the writers wrote about the fact that the gods would put limitations on mankind. The Greco-Romans or the Greeks at one point realized the gods were not really useful, and especially after the times of Alexander the Great, we started hearing questions about the power of the gods, and some humans started receiving deity-like descriptions because they were the ones who actually were doing something to help people, so the gods kind of got pushed aside. But it's interesting that the discussions that the Greeks had about the man and his relationship with fate and the gods really says that you can't do anything. You have no control whatsoever, which sounds like the Essenes. And I've actually pointed out quite a few times in other places that the Essenes seem to be the most influenced group by Greek thinking. And they were sometimes very, very reactional to this. Like, for example, the whole thing of using a pre-calculated calendar that uses only the sun, and where certain feasts have to fall on a Wednesday or a specific day of the week, basically very similar to the calendar of Jubilee in the Book of Enoch. This is a response to the Greek calendar, which was mostly lunar. So they were trying to say, oh, we're going to move away from them. But on the other hand, they were very heavily impressioned by the dualistic nature of Zoroastrianism and the belief in absolute fate, which came from the Greeks. So there's an interesting dynamic there. So a lot of people try to go and say, oh, the Dead Sea Scrolls tell us the truth about what we're supposed to believe in. And this is, I think it's called antiquinism or something like that. There's a word for it, of people that admire anything in antiquity without really taking into consideration issues that can exist about it. Like, for example, understanding that the Dead Sea Scrolls, some of them are sectarian writings and they don't represent the original thought of Israel, and these are pseudo writings under names and things like that, or descriptions that are basically fake. And we actually know that at this time, there was quite a bit of Jewish literature, for example, from Egypt, like, for example, the letter of Aristeas, or the Jewish sibyls, which are prophecies, fake prophecies. And we know that these were pseudo-writings, and these books, like the Book of Enoch and Jubilees, are also pseudo-writings of a very sectarian group. But basically, one of the things, for example, that we hear a lot today is this idea of trying to prove family curses, that the family curse is in the Bible. This is, by the way, to be very blunt, a very Greek concept. It does not appear anywhere in the Bible, not in the Hebrew Bible. Hebrew Bible, for example, Ezekiel 18, a father can do one thing, a son can do another, and they have different realities. So we have to understand that there's a lot of concepts about free will and what exactly is our relationship with God, which are strongly connected to the Greco-Roman period and discussions that philosophers and people of religion were having at the time. And today, and this is why I said Jewish philosophy is an oxymoron, the Tanakh is not a book of philosophy, it's a book of theology, and it actually distances man from God, saying there are things that we basically can't comprehend. We don't know why they happen. So stop attempting to explain them. You know, it's like in the end of the book of Kohelet, of Ecclesiastes, that he says, you know, writing many books is not good. The idea of writing many books, what he's really trying to say here is that certain searches in philosophy, certain ways of thinking, are just things that are futile. We don't have the physical ability to actually understand and comprehend why things are structured the way they're structured. You just have to let it be. Now, so that's about free choice. I hope you enjoyed that. The next thing that we have here, and this is going to be relatively short, is understanding the role of the Nile in Egyptian culture and understanding why the first couple of attacks on Egypt were actually through the Nile. The attack of blood and the attack of frogs are all connected to the Nile, besides the fact that a frog was also an Egyptian deity that had to do, I think, with fertility. A lot of deities had to do with fertility. I think it was fertility in this case, but I'm not too sure. But in any case, first of all, there's this big question of why the sequence of plagues are done the way they're done. And I think that one of the possible answers here is that each plague attacked something else, or every bunch of plagues attacked something else in the Egyptian world, with the pinnacle being the attack on the firstborn, which is more retaliation of harming God's firstborn. But what we have here is possibly an attack on gods and economics in the Egyptian world. Now, we need to understand that the Nile was probably the most important governing element in the Egyptian world. And this went on for a very long time. And to this very day, the Nile is the most important body of water in Egypt, and the Egyptians live mostly around the Nile, and the rest of Egypt is more or less desolate. There's just deserts and everything. And the Egyptians basically lived around the Nile, and their entire culture was built around the Nile, and their calendar was based upon the Nile, and they really lived all around the Nile. And the problem that we basically have here is that if you strike the Nile, the problem the Egyptians had was if you strike the Nile, you've basically crippled Egypt. And this was an opening of the rest of the attacks, which represent, I'm going to cripple you. I'm going to literally bring you down to your knees, because without the Nile, Egypt cannot exist. It's the calendar. It's the way they grow their food. It is the way the government can take taxations. There was, for example, a special position in the Egyptian world, which was the man, also in other cultures as well, the Mesopotamian cultures as well. But in Egypt, for example, they had the person who was in charge of all the offshoots of the Nile into the fields, all the little streams they had to dig to bring water from the Nile to the fields, which affected taxation, which affected what people could eat, which affected the crown. And this was a very, very high-ranking position in the ancient world, especially in Egypt. So an attack on the Nile was an attack on all of Egypt. And it's basically kind of a hint to things to come, that Egypt will be crippled. Now, the Nile itself, I mean, the word Nilus is a very late name. I mean, the Bible refers to it as the Ye'ol, and Ye'ol is basically a Hebrew form of an Egyptian word, a Hebraized form of an Egyptian word that represents bodies of water in general. And Egypt has, you know, there's the White Nile, the Blue Nile, and there's some lakes in a few places. but the attack itself, and you know, understanding the fact that this is some, there's also some kind of a military strategy here of attacking symbolic things as well, is also very important to understanding what happens here. There have been a lot of attempts throughout the centuries to try to explain, try to group the plagues in different ways, trying to make a logic here, and so on. But it's very, very difficult. It's very, very difficult to do this. Now, there was another interesting thing that came up about the word tanin. Now, I made a video, the first video I'd ever done on YouTube, which was more of an experiment, was regarding the word tanin. And the word tanin appears, first of all, the word tanin in Hebrew basically means crocodile. It doesn't mean snake. And you actually see that if you look closely in the Hebrew, when Moses does the miracle with the staff in front of Israel, it turns, it uses the word nahash, which is snake. On the other hand, when he does it in front of Pharaoh and his servants, the word used there is tanin. Now, there are a few places where the word tanin might relate to the concept of a snake. It is possible. However, there's something symbolic here on actually turning into a crocodile, and that has to do with the way some of the pharaohs saw themselves. If you actually go to the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel speaks about Pharaoh, and he refers to him as the tanin. You know, he basically refers to him as a crocodile. So the idea of appearing before Israelites who come from more around the land of Israel, where snakes represented a scary element more than crocodiles and so on, to take a snake and show you have control over a snake shows also the ability to control life and death, which was a divine concept. If you can control life and death, you basically have divine power. And snakes represented life and death amongst a lot of cultures, including the element of healing. So snakes were considered to be divine because they can kill. And they were a representation of something people feared. So there was, and turning some inanimate object into a snake and bringing it back into a stick represent the ability to control life and death. And this is why the staff had to be turned into these different animals. But for the Israelites, it was a snake because of what the snake represented to Israelite culture. And maybe even the memories of the snake in the Garden of Eden and so on. On the other hand, a crocodile to the Egyptians would represent the crown, would represent the power of Pharaoh, the power of the Nile, and Pharaoh and the Nile. And therefore, turning into a crocodile would make a lot more sense than turning into a snake. Besides the fact that it uses two different words, and in one text, it's a little difficult to say, oh, both words mean the same thing, because we're trying to say that, you know, it was a snake here, it must be a snake here. But no, what was done before Pharaoh was a demonstration of power on two levels. One, the power of control, life and death, turning a stick, a staff, into a living being, which even amongst the Egyptians was considered to be a divine power. It was to prove to Pharaoh that Moses appears in the name of an actual god. And the Egyptians, it was very important to the Egyptians to prove that they can do it as well, because they wanted to prove that they also had divine power. But the other side of it as well, as I said, is the element of the crocodile representing the crown, saying, you see this crocodile? You see this stuff? I can play around with this as much as I like. I have power and authority over you as one who comes by in the name of the only true creator of the universe. And that's why there has to be a difference between the nahash and the tanin here. And most of the time, tanin, by the way, represents, in most places, it represents a crocodile, and not a snake. It's very rare in some metaphors there's an element of crocodile, but that's even those are questionable. We can maybe discuss that some other time. Maybe I'll redo the idea of what is a tanin in the Bible with more demonstrations of verses. But in any case, that's something about the difference between nahash and tanin in this source. Now, the Khartoumim, the name Khartoumim, by the way, is another Egyptian word, which are people who are part of an interior council of Pharaoh. And it's like the word Khartam, something like that, Khartatam, something like that, which basically means people of the council of Pharaoh. And we also have, these are basically heads or leaders. So these might be people who are regional leaders. that also had ability to do certain magic. They might have been, you know, the connection between the priests' magic and leaders of the certain areas, especially if these areas were governed by temples, was very, very common. Temples were strongly connected to the community around them, and these might be represents of the temples, which means if you're part of a temple or a priest, you usually knew something about magic because it was an integral part of the Egyptian religion. We also have an interesting thing here. It says in verse 11 that it says that they're referred to as chachamim and mechashvim, which are wise men and sorcerers. And they're also, but they're also referred to as Chartumei Mitzrayim. It might be a parallel here. So these wise men and sorcerers are also people who are part of the leadership, and they do it with lahatehem. And the word lahat is related to the word lot, which probably means something which is done in secrecy. Sorcery is usually secret. You don't reveal your secrets to others. Maybe it's that. We're not necessarily sure. There's some discussions about this. But in any case, there's a lot more to say here. I've discussed some of them. For example, what exactly is the Arov? What is the Arov mentioned in chapter 8, verse 17? And some translations say that this is a type of fly that bites. Some other sources say it's some kind of like hordes of like mosquitoes or something very, very uncomfortable. Jewish sources, for example, try to claim that this is an irbuv. The arov comes with arav, which means a lot of animals showed up simultaneously from different places. Whatever the case may be, some of the oldest sources that we have talk more about flies and creatures of that nature, not necessarily lions and so on. But in any case, we have that as well. It's an interesting discussion. And also, another thing about the... at the end of this parasha, we also have the hail. And what's interesting, it says that it was hail with fire going across, and the fire is burning inside the hail. I actually want to argue against this interpretation. What I actually want to say is that there was hail, and together with the hail, there was probably lightning. And when it says Vayi Varad, this is chapter 9, verse 24, Vayi Varad ve'esh mitlakachat betoch habarad kaved me'od. I don't know if betoch here necessarily means inside the hail itself, that you have a piece of ice with fire in it, like some people try to interpret. Maybe betoch is like the word tavich, which means in between, that there was hail, and in between the hail there was fire. That we can understand the word betoch, and this is one of the issues with prepositions, is that they can have multiple meanings. So betoch maybe actually means batavich, between, that there was hail, and there was some kind of something that brought fire, maybe massive lightning that caused fires in the fields. And this is one serious thing, because in Egypt, by the way, hail is relatively rare. I mean, we've seen hail that was the size of baseballs and ping pong balls and so on that caused a lot of damage. It's possible. It's physically possible. There have been a lot of attempts to try to explain the miracles of Egypt or the plagues of Egypt through science. And some of these things are possible. If you have a really, really bad storm, a thunderstorm, a lightning storm together with heavy hail, it can cause fire and so on. And the last thing that we have here really is the word aviv. It says in verse 31, "Vapishta v'asora nukata ki asora aviv apishta giv'ol." And a lot of people ask this question: is aviv only related to the concept of barley? And I mostly hold to the idea that aviv is a stage. And it's a stage where you have a full-grown stalk and a grain inside, but this stage known as aviv can also happen with other grain-like things like besides barley, you have wheat, you have oats, and so on. This is not necessarily just barley; it's a stage that can happen with other things as well. But the reason the month of aviv, where we actually celebrate Hagamatzot, is specifically based on the barley, because the barley is the first one to ripen, and it's more of a period. But the month of aviv, that's when barley reaches its point of aviv, and then a bit later that after that, but it's still in the same period, wheat reaches its stage of aviv as well. So it's the month of it because two main elements of several actually main elements of grains in the land actually reach their point known as Aviv. So Aviv is not necessarily limited to barley, but it's for the calendar, it's connected directly to the barley itself. In any case, I hope you enjoyed this recording. As always, if there are any questions, you can email me, you can comment on Facebook, you can comment on the website, you can email me at hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. I've actually received some really good feedback on different things that I do, and I want to thank everyone. As always, if you're interested in lessons in biblical Hebrew, lessons in biblical history, lessons on elements of archaeology, things of that nature, specific classes on specific books of the Bible, if you're interested, things like that. All these things I offer as part of my business as well. And you can contact me again at hebrewinisrael@gmail.com, hebrewinisrael, one word. And you can also contact me through the Facebook page, also in the messages. You can message me through there and ask questions. And as always, thank you for joining me again. Hope you enjoyed this. And may you all have a blessed Shabbat. Thank you.